Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Sixty-five-year-old Susan Malden had built a quiet life for herself in Florida. She had friends, a routine, and a home she was trying to keep up with. Then, in October 2019, she was gone. Without warning, no goodbyes. At first, people thought maybe she left town, gone back to England, where she still had family ties. But the details just didn't add up. Her car was still in the driveway, and inside her home, a bathroom ripped apart mid-renovation. As investigators asked questions, red flags started popping up left and right. Missing money, shifting stories, and a final conversation no one realized would be her last. Then came the security footage. A contractor, praised as the Michelangelo of his trade, caught on camera buying something that made investigators stop in their tracks. Heavy-duty demolition bags and 60 pounds of concrete. Join me now as we uncover a case that led to FBI intervention, a search through thousands of tons of landfill waste, and a defense built on cocaine, forged checks, and claims of brain damage. Because Susan Malden didn't just disappear, someone made her disappear. Outside Susan Malden's home on Fleming Island, Florida, the scene was anything but ordinary. A crowd had gathered, 22 people in total, neighbors, friends, standing together on her front lawn as news crews got ready to interview them. It was January, but the decorations outside Susan's front door didn't seem to know what time of year it was. Two pumpkins, left behind long after Halloween had passed. And beside them, a Christmas wreath. A front porch stuck between holidays, like time had stopped. And in many ways, for Susan Malden, it had. Bright yellow police tape flapped in the breeze, marking the house as a crime scene. The people standing on Susan's lawn smiled awkwardly as they took turns stepping up to be interviewed. But all smiles vanished when they started speaking. They were worried and angry. They hadn't seen Susan in months, and they wanted something done about it. It's been 81 days. 81 days, one Fleming Island resident told the reporter. That's not acceptable. Susan had vanished in October 2019, but months after being reported missing, there didn't appear to be any sense of urgency in her case, and there were no real answers. Although Susan was a 65-year-old widow with no relatives in the country, that didn't mean she was alone. She'd built a life in Florida with a tight-knit circle of friends who cared about her and noticed when she wasn't where she was supposed to be. And now, the trust she'd built had come full circle. The people stepping up, demanding answers, were people she'd built deep and meaningful relationships with, and they were refusing to let her disappearance be ignored. But what Susan's friends didn't realize was that detectives were very close to discovering exactly where she was. Susan Elizabeth Maldon was born in September 1954 in England. She'd married John Maldon, a U.S. Navy veteran, 25 years older. And in 1997, they settled down in Fleming Island, Florida, ready for retirement. Their home at 1872 Harbor Island Drive was brand new. 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, a 2-car garage. Just the right size. Not too big, not too small. But by 2006, John had passed away, leaving Susan alone and with a choice to make. Pack up and go back to England, where she still had family, or stay in Florida, where she had no one. Susan chose to stay. Building a life from scratch can be hard for anyone, but doing it alone, in a place that still felt foreign, that takes a different kind of strength. Strength Susan proved she had. To find friends and a sense of community, she joined a British expat club, a gardening group, and a knitting circle. And slowly but surely, she had friends to call, places to go, and things to do. But despite her full social life and strong independence, maintaining her home was becoming a challenge. At first, it was just small things. Peeling paint, a broken cabinet hinge, things her friend's husband could help fix. But then, one leak turned into something worse. Her dishwasher had been dripping unnoticed, and by the time Susan caught it, it was too late. Water damage had spread through her kitchen, rotting the cabinets. She knew it was a job that required professional help. That's when she met Corey Binderim, a local contractor. Now, if you've ever had to hire a contractor, you know what a gamble it can be. Maybe you get someone skilled, professional and honest. Or maybe you get someone who does a shoddy job, overcharges, or even worse, disappears with all your money. Well, for an elderly woman like Susan living alone, the risks go even further. Because the risk of letting a contractor into your home, someone who's a perfect stranger, is no longer just about money. It's about personal safety. Susan had every reason to believe Corey was trustworthy. He'd given her a reasonable quote, promised quality work, and when it came time to deliver, he followed through. He handled their kitchen remodel without any issues, and when the job was done, she had no complaints. And that's why it made the most sense to hire him again for the bathroom work she needed done. So Corey took a look and ran the numbers. It was a full gut job needed, right down to the studs. He quoted $12,000, but he wanted it up front. It wasn't cheap, but major renovations never are, and Susan paid him in full. At first, everything seemed to be going smoothly. Corey ripped out the sink, the shower, and the tiles, tearing the room down to nothing but the exposed pipes and bare drywall, exactly what you'd expect in the early stages of a remodel. The real work would come next. Except, it didn't. Because right after the demo, Corey disappeared. At first, Susan didn't panic. She didn't fly off the handle like we often see people do these days on social media when things don't go their way. She'd been taught to be patient, not to make a fuss, and certainly not make a scene. Growing up, she'd learned to give people the benefit of the doubt, to assume they'd honor what they said they'd do. So when Corey missed a day, Susan barely noticed. A week? Well, that was a bit irritating, but not unheard of. Contractors get behind schedule all the time. Things happen, at least. That's what she probably told herself. But as weeks stretched into months, Corey's reassurances started sounding like excuses. I'll be there next week. Something came up. Just give me a little more time. By September, Susan had reached her limit. Her bathroom was still gutted, unusable, and Corey nowhere to be found. When Susan finally did manage to track him down, she told him he was fired and that she wanted her money back. And surprisingly, Corey didn't argue. He promised to repay her in installments, and for a moment, it seemed like he just might make things right. Until he didn't. Instead of giving Susan a certified check, he handed her a $1,500 personal check, which she took one look at and refused. She'd been patient and polite up to now, but wasn't some naive homeowner who was going to be strung along. Since Corey had already vanished once, Susan knew there was a high probability he'd do it again. So what were her options? She could cut her losses, except that Corey had taken her for a ride, and take the financial hit. She could keep fighting him, hoping if she applied enough pressure, he'd finally do the right thing. Or she could escalate things and contact someone who could actually hold him accountable legally. Susan discussed her contractor conundrum with friends, weighing out her choices. And the truth was, none of the options were any good. Each had the potential to cause unwanted drama and a tiresome battle she had no interest in. But Corey had left her with no choice when he canceled another meeting with her at the last minute. She made up her mind. It was time to bring out the big guns. She told friends she was going to the police, possibly even a lawyer. That was October 24th, 2019, the last day anyone saw Susan Maldon alive. In the 2011 documentary, Dreams of a Life, the story told of a woman who died alone in her apartment and wasn't discovered for 2 years. The film left people with a haunting question. If something happened to you, how long would it take for someone to notice and came looking? For 65-year-old Susan Maldon, the answer was one day. Susan may not have had relatives who lived nearby or children to check in on her, but she did have Phyllis, her best friend for over a decade. For years, they'd met weekly on Wednesdays for a lunch date, at the same time, at the same place, no cancellations. No excuses. So when October 24th rolled around, and when Susan didn't show up for lunch or pick up the phone, Phyllis knew something was wrong. That's when she asked her husband to go by Susan's place and check in on her. When he got there, he peered through her garage window to see if her car was there, and it was. Next, he went to her kitchen window, expecting to see Susan sitting at the table, sipping tea like always, but she wasn't. The house was still, silent and empty. It was time to call police and report Susan missing. When Phyllis told police, Susan's last known plan was to confront her bathroom contractor, a man she'd been having serious issues with. Detectives knew exactly where to start their investigation. Corey Binderin's home.
Corey Binderin?
Yes.
Yeah. I just want to follow up with you a couple questions.
Okay.
That's okay.
That's fine.
All right.
But on their first visit to see him, they didn't get far into their questioning. So they returned a few days later. This time, their body cams captured the audio of their interaction. Detectives played it cool, like they weren't there to accuse Corey of anything, just to clear up some things and to see if he knew where Susan might be. They even tossed him a lifeline, suggesting she'd wandered off on her own. Maybe even dementia was to blame.
We are concerned about her, and that's what I want to talk to you about. Because in these cases, every little tiny detail
right.
can help us maybe find her. I don't know if maybe she got dementia, if she wandered off. Because I don't know. You've dealt with her
over the last few months. Yeah.
Trying to contract with her or whatever, so you probably know her way better than I do.
As the conversation continued, Corey did something interesting. he started pointing in other directions. Maybe the detectives were looking at the wrong person. Maybe they should start talking to one of Sue's many friends instead.
I talked with some of her friends who have a pretty good picture of her, but here
she was really social, so I'm sure she had plenty of friends. Yeah. I mean, I assume she talked about her group. She said that once. She mentioned a British bar because I told her my wife really liked, you know, British bars.
Then, out of nowhere, Corey started offering up information, details the detectives hadn't even asked for, admitting to seeing Susan the morning before she was reported missing.
I was supposed to be there between 8 and 8:30. I got there about 8, maybe a little bit sooner, a little earlier.
Was she expecting
you? Yeah, we had a meeting there. So I called her, and, you know, she answered, and so I said, hey, I'm here. And she asked me for 5 or 10 minutes, and she went by red, and then I sat at my truck, and she entered the door, and came out today, and she went inside, and went over the contract. What it was, this contract's been going on for a very long time. I demoed the bathroom, the guest bathroom, and I was supposed to do both of them, but we started on the guest bathroom. So I got a shower, I got the sub out, I got the vanity out, I hadn't taken the floor up or the toilet up yet. And it was just, she took about a month and a half to figure out what tile she wanted. She bought it, I went and got it, and delivered it.
Corey made sure to shift the blame, telling detectives that Susan had been the one dragging her feet on the remodel, not him. But as he spoke, his story started to drift, throwing in details that had nothing to do with the question at hand. And the more he rambled, the faster he got, like a man who knew he was talking himself into a corner.
Then it came time to talk about the tub and fixtures and all of that. She just couldn't make a decision. So fast forward, I was taking jobs in between, and then she was frustrated that I couldn't come over right now when she was ready. And so it just got to the point where it was just better for both of us if I just refunded her money. I went about my way, she could find somebody else. And that was the conversation. So we went through the paperwork, and I wrote her a check, and I had some stuff still there. I had a tool bag with some plumbing tools. I had a bin with some plumbing parts, and then there was a trash bag still there. So I loaded that in my truck, and she held the door for me.
What Corey didn't realize was that by the time detectives had knocked on his door, they'd already put together a picture of what they believed happened to Susan inside her home, because they already processed it as a crime scene. And what they found wasn't good. Blood smears on the living room floor and kitchen, even on a lampshade. And among Susan's neatly kept belongings, they found something else. Her journals. Page after page, with meticulous notes, detailing her daily life, her frustrations, and most importantly, her ongoing battle with Corey Binderim. From the very beginning, she'd written everything down, and it didn't take long for investigators to realize it hadn't been Susan holding up the renovation. She'd been waiting on Corey, chasing him down, trying to get her money back, and now she was gone. The first time detectives showed up at Corey's house, they played it cool. But when they knocked again, they arrived with a search warrant for Corey's truck.
Hello?
Hey, Glenn, how are you?
Hi.
What's doing all right, man?
Yeah.
I catch you just getting home from work?
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
What can I do for you?
Same old man, just wanted to talk to you about your truck.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
At Corey's house this time, his wife and daughter were there, which meant he had an audience. And whatever was about to be said, Corey's family was going to hear.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, hey, sorry.
What's going on?
Hey,
I don't think we met.
This is my wife, Cassie.
Hey, Captain Fryer, nice to meet you, Cassie.
Hey.
Can we talk for a second? You all right
with
that?
Sure. Yeah.
Just him?
Yeah. Is that okay? I know wives worry.
Oh.
So, here's the deal.
obviously, I talked to you before about this whole thing.
Yep.
And we've been following up because we still haven't found her.
Mm.
Okay. Susan. So we don't know where she's at.
So you're checking boxes.
Checking boxes. That's what I'm doing. So can you tell me what happened to her?
I don't know. I don't have any clue. We shook hands. I left. That's it. That's the last I know of. I don't have an explanation. I don't have anything.
Yeah. I mean, I got.
I mean, the guy was mowing the yard and mowing the lawn across the street. She shook my hand in the doorway.
Yeah. I got a, I've been in that house all week long.
Okay.
And I've been going through a lot of things.
I was there for 20 minutes at best.
She clearly did not want to talk to you anymore. She was done with you.
Right in the middle of detectives pressing Corey about Susan's disappearance, he did something that left them stunned. He hit the pause button. Not on his nerves, not to gather his thoughts, but to take a work call. Because apparently, in Corey's world, being accused of murder was just another inconvenience.
$1,294.54.
Hey, Nancy. Hey, I see you. They're investigating me for a woman being missing.
When detectives pointed out scratches on Corey's arm, the implication was clear. They suspected how he got them. But instead of getting rattled, Corey got cheeky. He flipped the script and started questioning the officer about his wounds instead.
So you have a scratch on your arm?
I probably do. I'm like you. I do a little bit of work around the house.
How old's
I do
that
a little
one?
Work around the boat. This one right here?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good couple months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed you were saying mine was old.
This one
was yesterday.
This one? Right here on
that
your
was yesterday.
Thumb?
Yesterday or the day before?
But it's clotted and scabbed already.
Yeah, it's a screw.
That's
it's a screw
cool.
gun that kicked off
Did you
off
miss
of the
and
screw
hit it? Oh,
went into me. Yesterday or the day before?
Shit.
I have scratches and cuts all over me all
that
the time.
That sucks. But this one on your wrist, you don't know.
Where?
Could have just been anything.
This one?
Yeah, this whole thing right here.
I don't know. I mean, they're all old.
Yeah.
And I have scratches and cuts all over me.
As detectives wrapped up their questioning with Corey, they went back to work. But as they continued investigating, Corey landed himself in a different kind of legal trouble and was arrested on an unrelated forgery charge. Locked up behind bars, he had no idea that detectives were still working away, retracing his steps, piecing together Susan's last movements. And then they found something. Footage captured at a nearby Home Depot recorded the morning Susan vanished. At first glance, it seemed like nothing unusual, just another customer running errands. But then they realized who they were looking at, Corey Binderham. Pushing a cart down an aisle, grabbing exactly what he needed, heavy-duty demolition bags, and 60 pounds of concrete. The footage wasn't proof of a crime, not on its own. After all, Corey was a contractor. Buying concrete in demolition bags wasn't exactly unheard of. But the timing of it all, now that was suspicious. That made detectives want to look closer. And the deeper they looked, the worse it got for Corey. On that day in January 2020, when Susan's friends gathered on her lawn in front of a news crew, they had no idea where detectives were at in their investigation. They also had no idea that the FBI had joined the case and were working alongside the Clay County Sheriff's Office and the state's attorney's office. And then, 10 days after the news story aired, the team mobilized. 40 investigators, 12-hour shifts. Their destination? A place no one ever wants to visit. The Chesser Island Road landfill in Folkestone, Georgia. a sprawling wasteland where garbage from Clay County was funneled. Rotting waste, twisted metal, and broken furniture. Somewhere in that mountain of decay, detectives believed they'd find Susan Maldon. But the team had to work fast. Every day that passed meant that more trash piled on top, more evidence lost to time. So for 9 days straight, they dug through 7,300 tons of garbage, sorting through the unspeakable, picking apart pieces of other people's lives, hoping to find what was left of Susan's. And then they found something, a human skull. It was fragile, damaged by its surroundings, but still intact enough for dental records to confirm what they already feared. It was Susan. Nearby, in a discarded bag, they also found more of her remains. The forensic pathologist who conducted the autopsy ruled the manner of death was homicide. The cause, blunt force trauma, with strangulation as a contributing factor. At that point, detectives weren't asking if Susan had been murdered. They were asking when and how. And they knew the only person who had the answers, Corey Binderham. On March 3rd, 2020, Corey was arrested for the murder of Susan Maldon. But he didn't have to go far, because thanks to those unrelated forgery charges, Corey was already sitting in a cell at the Duval County Jail, waiting. In October 2024, the prosecution called their first witnesses, the couple who reported Susan missing. When they took the stand, they told the jury details they already knew, that Susan was reliable, never missed her weekly lunch date with Phyllis, and that in the days leading up to her disappearance, she'd been fed up with her contractor. But then, on cross-examination, something unexpected came up. A detail that hadn't been the focus before. A detail the defense wanted the jury to hear. According to them, Susan had a habit of helping people, and sometimes it was the wrong kind of people. They claimed Susan had befriended a vagrant at one point, a man with unclear intentions, someone they suggested might have taken advantage of Susan's kindness.
And then he contacted, did he not?
I believe he did. I never met him.
Yeah. He contacted her and they got together. Is that right?
They pointed out that Susan had prescription pain medication in her house and that maybe this mystery man had seen an opportunity.
She told you that she had some pain pills in her house and he wants some of her pain pills.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Maybe he was the one with reason to harm Susan. And that was the first glimpse of what was coming. The beginning of the defense's strategy to make Susan's biggest strength, her kindness, seem like her biggest and most dangerous weakness. To shift the focus and plant just enough doubt. Because in a courtroom, sometimes doubt is all you need. The only problem with the defense's strategy was that the timeline didn't fit. Susan's interactions with the unnamed vagrant had lined up with the days surrounding her disappearance. Even so, it made people pause. Until then, it seemed like everyone in Susan's circle had been trustworthy. Now, there was a sliver of doubt, and for the defense, that was enough to work with. To reinforce their argument, they brought in a DNA analyst, a forensic expert who told the jury something they hadn't expected to hear. There was no forensic evidence linking Corey to Susan's murder. DNA had been collected from the bags containing her remains, but Corey had been excluded as a contributor. It was the kind of testimony that could make a jury hesitate, the kind that could plant a seed. and the defense pressed their luck. Next, they called one of Corey's former clients to the stand, a satisfied customer, someone who'd hired Corey and trusted him inside his home. And the person just didn't vouch for Corey's work. He praised him, calling him the Michelangelo of home renovations, a man with skill, precision, and craftsmanship. Not the kind of person who'd throw it all away over a bathroom remodel dispute.
Painted, took down the wallpaper, painted it, then the master bathroom. There was awful wallpaper, which my wife and I had tried to take down, but we'd kind of botched the job. So he had repaired that, mud the wall. And I mean, it was like watching a Michelangelo at work. He was just a master with the mud and how smooth and everything was. And you know, you could just see he really, everything he did just took an incredible pride in his work.
The former client didn't stop there. He went on to describe Corey as a great guy, someone who cared about his customers. So much, he'd been known to knock a little off of the price of his work just to help someone out.
Yes, he would give me an estimate for each job based on the amount of time that he thought it would take and the amount of materials that he thought it would take. Actually, after the first job, he didn't even ask for the money for the materials up front. We just had a good relationship. He just said, just pay me as we go along. And several times, you know, it didn't take as long. I would approve an amount, but it didn't take as long as he was very efficient or didn't need as much materials. He was also very innovative in the way that he, you know, would reuse materials so it didn't have to, you know, always buy new stuff. So yes, he would just say, you know, that wasn't as hard as I thought, or wasn't, as, you know, just give me 800 instead of 1,000.
If you believe the testimony, Corey Binderham wasn't just a contractor. He was a man in high demand, catering to Florida's elite. A trusted name in the kind of circles where reputations matter, and only the best are invited through the front door.
At that time, he had multiple jobs. He was working some upscale homes in Ponte Vedra. So he would come, you know, he liked working in my house because it was Fleming Island where he also lived and was nearby and convenient. You know, I was pretty flexible with him because he was giving me very good prices and good service. So it wasn't every day, but he was there quite a bit during September, October.
But not everyone saw Corey as a picture of professionalism. Take one of his former employees who testified that while working together at a landfill, Corey made an offhand remark, a joke supposedly, that a place like this would be perfect for getting rid of a body.
There was, I had a teenage daughter at that time, and one of the boys at school put their hands on her, and I made a poor joke, and I said, you know, if they put their hands on my kid again, you know, this is where we're going to put the body. It was just a joke. It was not serious, and Corey was like, yes, this is where you'd put the body. But it was just a joke. It wasn't.
Fair enough. And when that was said, was it weeks, maybe even the earlier part of time, prior to when it was mold?
Yes.
Were you two actually at the landfill when this exchange took place?
We were. We were unloading the truck.
Then the prosecutor shifted gears and brought up the concrete, circling back to those Home Depot surveillance clips. The one showing Corey the morning Susan disappeared, loading 60 pounds of concrete into his cart.
Regarding the jobs that you were working on with him, did you ever see him use concrete?
No.
Never?
No.
Are you certain of that?
Yeah, most of the things we did was woodworking and flooring.
And yeah, just so our records clear, you only worked one for the 2 months approximately, right?
That's it, yes.
Sir. During that time period, you never saw a lot of concrete?
No, sir.
Then, Corey's wife of nearly 25 years took the stand, revealing something the jury hadn't heard before. Corey had a serious drug problem and a habit that doesn't come cheap. Suddenly, the prosecution wasn't just telling a story about a disgruntled contractor and an unpaid refund anymore. They were laying out something bigger. A man deep in addiction. A man in need of cash. And a woman who, in her final days, had been demanding her money back.
Can you tell the jury, when you first found out about his drug use, were you very surprised?
Oh, yes. I had no idea. When he told me, I want to say it was like May of that year, out of the blue, it hit me. We were completely surprised.
When he informed you about his drug use, did he tell you what type of drug he was using?
He did. He had told me that he was using cocaine.
And looking back, were you able to see that money had been missing?
Yes. At the time, he was still doing some construction, and he had been going through a lot of money. And what I thought at the time was in his jobs, I guess you could say, kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul, like he was using money from one job to help fund another. It was disappearing at a very fast rate. And I think that's what actually prompted him to come out to me that he had had a drug problem.
Corey's wife continued her testimony, filling in more of the picture. She told the jury that back in 2008, Corey had checked himself into an inpatient rehab. When he got out, he seemed to turn things around, landing a management job at UPS, bringing in a steady paycheck. But then came 2017, the year Corey left his corporate job and started his own remodeling company, not long before he met Susan. And while business should have been thriving, with six figures coming in, the money was disappearing. Then came the testimony of a jailhouse informant, someone Corey had been locked up with while serving time for forgery. And according to the informant, Corey had admitted to hitting and choking a client during a fight over money. When he got to the part about the choking, he mimed the motion himself, his hands wrapping around an invisible throat, just as he claimed Corey had done. It was a dramatic moment, one the jury wouldn't forget.
Yeah, said that she started getting loud and he was trying to shut her up. So he hit her or something. And then he started screaming and choked her out or something.
All right, you're doing something with your hands that the jury can't see. Can you lift your hands and show us what you're doing with your hands?
Yeah. That's what it looked like.
All right. Did he make that motion with his hands when he's telling you that?
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
After 10 days of testimony, the jury delivered its verdict. Corey Binderham was found guilty, convicted of first-degree murder, assault, and destroying evidence in the murder of 65-year-old Susan Malden. But the trial wasn't over. Next came the penalty phase, 2 days of arguments over what Corey's fate should be, and prosecutors didn't hold back. They asked the jury for the harshest sentence possible, death. 7 voted for execution, while 5 did not. In Florida, it takes 8 votes for a death sentence to stand. That meant Corey had avoided execution by a single vote. When it came time for sentencing, several of Susan's friends stood in the courtroom, ready to speak. They wanted the jury and Corey to understand the weight of what had been lost. They reminded the jury of what Susan really was, not just a victim, but a person who was loved and would be missed.
What took place in her home, which was really represented a safety and comfort for her, is now a constant reminder of the horror and loss of my true friend. She was not just a casual friend, she was the first friend I made when I entered this country in 2001. I was lucky to have her by my side. She quickly became my US family. Her generosity, her guidance was something I can always count on. She was one of the first people to make me feel comfortable and at home in what to me then was a foreign land. She loved to entertain and she was the perfect host. She would have many drinks, meals, stories, card games. We'd have great discussions over the 20 years that we were friends. Every day, I'm forced to drive past or walk my dog by the very place that I used to share those fun stories with, either have a cup of tea, glasses of wine, and long chats. It's a house I cannot avoid. It's a daily reminder of the reality of what took place there 5 years ago. Even as I try to go about just ordinary duties like walking my dog, I'm faced with the weight of what happened within that home. The emotional toll of this is not something that fades with time. It's a permanent scar that I've got to carry with me. She was not just a victim. She was someone full of life with so much still ahead of her.
It was a powerful statement. One that painted a picture of Susan as she really was. Not just an elderly widow living alone, but a woman who'd built a full life with friendships and a home she'd made her own. And while Susan's love of tea and gardening came as no surprise, one friend reminded the courtroom of another side of her.
One of our favorite pastimes was watching the Jacksonville Jaguars football. We didn't just watch the games. We critiqued, we strategized, and we joked about how we could be better coaches and sometimes even better players than they were. Now watching the games feels somewhat hollow without our spirited discussions and our shared enthusiasm. It's a reminder that she should still be here laughing, commenting us. We would still be having the same jokes and discussions right now about our team. She wasn't just a neighbor, she was a true friend. I've lost the comfort of knowing that she is just a walk or a phone call away. There is no justice that can ever bring her back or heal the wounds that's been left in our hearts. But I am here today not only to honor her memory, but make sure that her voice is heard.
Corey Binderham was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In 2022, Susan's home was sold. It was bought as is, with the bathroom still unfinished, looking no different than in the photo shown to the jury during trial. The place where Susan had fought for a refund, stood her ground, and made her final stand, left frozen in time. In the aftermath of her murder, one question kept rising to the surface. Would things have ended differently if Susan had been someone else? What if she'd been one of Corey's wealthier male clients? Someone with money, power, and influence? Would she have faced the same fate? But for those who knew and loved Susan, the what-ifs didn't matter. Because Susan had already proven something far more important. That while tearing something down can be easy, building a life takes strength, patience, perseverance, and the kind of love that leaves a mark long after you're gone. And Susan put in that effort. She hadn't just relocated to Florida. She'd rebuilt her life entirely from the ground up. She'd made friends who became family and created a community around her she could depend on. And that's something Corey Binderham never counted on. Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.